Welcome to a podcast for the Queensland Integrity in Health series. I'm Dr. Nicola Stepanov, the Queensland Integrity Commissioner. Each year, the Office of the Integrity Commissioner, together with its supporting partners, including Health Ethics and Law Queensland, or HEAL, among others, arranges an Integrity in Health series. This year's topic is mandatory reporting for health professionals. What are the ethical and legal ramifications? This year, as a result of global pandemic, which is presently underway, we're convening this series as a podcast, and today I'm delighted to be sharing our integrity and health journey with our partners, the Office of the Health Ombudsman, Doctors Health in Queensland, Avant, and of course, HEAL, which is the Queensland chapter of the Australasian Association of Bioethics and Health Law. Joining me as co-host during this series are Tracy Pickett, who's a medico-legal advisor with Avant and also a board director of the Queensland Doctors Health Program, Dr. Margaret Kay, the medical director working with Doctors Health in Queensland, and Melissa Nadeau, the chief medical officer and head of clinical innovation for NIB. We've got a stellar lineup of interviewees for our podcasts, including Dr. Claire Walker, who's the immediate past president of the Queensland Rural Doctors Association and an outback GP with obstetric and anaesthetic specialties, Dr. Alex Markswell, who's an emergency physician at the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital and Greenslopes Private Hospital and also chair of the Queensland Clinical Senate, and Andrew Brown, the Queensland Health Ombudsman. However, today joining me is Professor Malcolm Parker. Welcome, Mal.
Hi, Nicola. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Now, Mal, before I hit you with some tough questions, I'd like to tell our listeners a little bit about you. So Mal graduated in medicine from UQ in 1975. After internships in Queensland's hospitals, he worked in general practice in the UK and then in Queensland for 33 years. Overlapping this clinical role was an academic one, and Mal joined the UQ Medical School in 1994, where he developed the Ethics, Personal and Professional Development domain for the new graduate medical course. Over the next two decades, he developed and implemented the curriculum for the Ethics, Law and Professional Practice. He was the inaugural head of the discipline of medical ethics and the first such formally constituted and recognised discipline in Australia. That's very impressive, Mal. One of the academic staff members, of course, of the discipline, and no doubt his favourite, was me prior to moving into more general ethics and law matters and prior to my joining as the Integrity Commissioner. So in parallel with Mal's teaching achievements, he also has a very strong research career and was instrumental in steering UQ in its first ERA submission in applied ethics to a rank of 4, which is above the world standard. He's also published nationally and internationally in philosophy of medicine, bioethics, medical law, health law, and medical education. I've got to take a breath, Mal. That's a lot of things. So Mal was active in the Professional Bioethics and Health Law Associations of Australasia from 1991. He's the inaugural and immediate past president of the Australasian Association of Bioethics and Health Law. He was also a member of the Health and Performance Committees of the Medical Board of Queensland, the Medical Board of Australia, and a long-serving director of the Postgraduate Medical Council of Queensland, and a member and chair of UQ's Senior Research Ethics Committee, the Human Experimentation Ethical Review Committee. Mal's currently the Emeritus Professor of Medical Ethics at UQ and also an Adjunct Professor with Health Law Research Centre at QUT. Wow, what a history, Mal. So today, I'd actually like to ask you some questions on the two really important components of our topic. And we're going to tackle professional conduct and the culture of medicine today. So let's get started, shall we? So my first question, Mal, can you outline the context of mandatory reporting for health professionals?
Sure, thanks, Nicola. Well, mandatory reporting for conduct and health impairment is part of a wide range of mandatory notifications applying variably to different health and other professionals, and also sometimes to members of the public. For example, doctors and nurses, but also teachers, the police, childhood carers and educators are required to notify suspected child abuse and neglect. Some notifications concerning doctors are not mandatory but are encouraged, like reporting adverse drug reactions. Some are only mandatory for doctors in some jurisdictions, for example, medical fitness to drive in South Australia and the Northern Territory, but not the other states and territory. But in many situations, doctors in all jurisdictions must report qualifying cases to the authorities. and these include suspected child abuse and neglect, notifiable conditions such as measles, immunisations, drug-dependent persons, cancer, and a number of others. And for 10 years now, there is notifiable conduct of health professionals. Like the other examples that I've given, reporting notifiable conduct aims to protect the public from various threats to life, health, and welfare. But the unique aspect of mandatory reporting for health professionals is that protecting the public depends on health professionals and some institutions reporting on their colleagues under prescribed conditions. This constitutes a legislated erosion of part of the self-regulation function of the health professions and explains the controversy over its introduction and implementation, particularly in the case of medical practitioners.
You've made some really important points there, Mal, and in part that is why we've chosen the topic for this year, because of all of the, because it is a rather controversial topic, and there is a lot of uncertainty for medical practitioners and other health professionals. So, Mal, would you briefly describe the structure of mandatory reporting of notifiable conduct for health professionals in Australia for our listeners?
Sure. Notifiable conduct for health professionals covers four areas. I'll number them. One, practicing while intoxicated by alcohol or drugs. Two, engaging in sexual misconduct in connection with practicing. Three, placing the public at risk of harm because the practitioner has an impairment. And four, placing the public at risk of harm because the practitioner has made a significant departure from accepted professional standards. There are three categories of notifiers. There are practitioners who treat other health professionals. There are all the other practitioners who are termed non-treating practitioners. And thirdly, there are the employers of health professionals, for example, hospitals and other institutions. Notifiers are not confined to notifying only practitioners in their own particular health profession. So doctors might notify a board of a nurse's conduct, for example, or vice versa. But the notifier must notify the board of the practitioner whose conduct is deemed to be notifiable. Since mandatory reporting was introduced, there have been some changes to the defined thresholds of risk and level of harm for the different categories of notifiers. These changes also reflect tensions between self-regulation and external regulation, in particular relating to impaired practitioners.
Mm. And I think the topic of impaired practitioners is such a difficult one as well, because, you know, that point when, you know, at what point are you meant to notify? It's really quite uncertain in some cases. So, Mal, you indicated that one of the unique features of mandatory reporting is that it involves protecting members of the public. However, it's done because you've got health professionals essentially reporting their concerns about their colleagues. So it does make inroads into the profession in terms of self-regulation. And it also provides a bit of an explanation as to why introducing mandatory reporting is controversial and it still remains quite contested. Can you expand on this a bit more, in particular in relation to impaired doctors?
Sure. Let me first say a few things about professions per se and recent challenges to professional autonomy or independence. So we usually understand the traditional professions in the following ways. Their members are members of social groups which have specialised knowledge and skills that benefit the public. This is developed via rigorous education and training. They profess high standards of competence and behaviour, and these standards are maintained through self-regulation processes, and members of the professions are accorded trust and autonomy by society in return for these assurances. But professional autonomy has been challenged in a number of ways. And this has occurred over recent decades in the context of things like the increase in public education and the greater recognition of human rights. And so we've seen the autonomy, authority, and the right to self-regulation of the medical profession in particular being challenged in specific ways. Now, here's a couple of examples. The professions, all the professions, not just the health professions, were brought under national competition policy law from the 1990s, and this forced them to operate more as commercial enterprises and less as autonomous professions. Critics would say as closed shops. We've seen state-based health rights commissions becoming established alongside the existing health practitioner boards. In Queensland, the Health Ombudsman has wrested management of the more serious misconduct and other matters from the medical board. Thirdly, the medical and the other health professional boards themselves have been reformed with increasing community representation. And finally, 10 years ago, the National Registration and Accreditation Scheme established national health practitioner boards with numerous Australia-wide functions, efficiencies and standards. Some of the new processes, including mandatory reporting, were designed to strengthen protection of the public in the areas of clinical competence and conduct, and the risks associated with practitioner impairment. Areas that hitherto were regulated more exclusively by the health professions themselves.
That whole idea of professional autonomy as well is something that resonates with me as an old hospital trained nurse in the 80s, and we had that huge move in nursing to change it from being a vocation to being recognised as a profession. So it is really important to think about professional autonomy as well. You know, having spent some time as the acting health ombudsman, I did see some of those misconduct matters and some of the issues that arise for health professionals when they're reporting on the conduct of others. So Mal, how did mandatory reporting arise?
Okay, well, mandatory reporting had been on the agenda for at least a decade leading up to the National Registration and Accreditation Scheme. I'll describe three jurisdictions: New Zealand, New South Wales, and Queensland, and then some aspects of the national scheme. So New Zealand introduced legislation in 2003, responding to an inquiry into a notorious case of unconsented experimental treatment from the 1980s, to subsequent reports, and also to a growing perception of doctors not reporting poor practice and protecting their own. The New Zealand Medical Association strongly rejected the inclusion of mandatory reporting obligations in this new legislation, and their lobbying and the lobbying of other groups resulted in discretionary rather than mandatory notifications of substandard practice that risked harm to the public. And so this retained an emphasis on an ethical obligation to report, or a professional obligation, rather than a legal obligation, that the New Zealand Medical Association had defended during the lobbying process. And this thus protected the self-regulation function of medicine and the other professions regarding competence and behaviour. New South Wales introduced mandatory reporting legislation for doctors in 2008. Public pressure responded to a case of egregious clinical incompetence that harmed several women, but also to the inadequate practice supervision by the then regulator, the board or the council as it was in New South Wales. Again, it was recognised that reporting motivated by medical ethical obligations does occur, but there was also a public perception of reluctance to report colleagues and a closed shop culture within medicine. The New South Wales legislation required reporting of sexual misconduct, practising while intoxicated, or flagrantly departing from accepted practice standards that risks harm. But it was restricted to a reasonable belief about serious and obvious failures with a clear potential for harm, rather than merely a suspicion. As in New Zealand, the Medical Board of New South Wales and the AMA already encourage notification of health conduct or performance posing a threat to the public, but these ethical imperatives had been shown to fail both individually and systemically. Moving now to Queensland, local motivations for change in Queensland focused initially on the well-known case of Dr. Patel and his surgical incompetence and other misdemeanours, and the failure of colleagues and hospital administrators to notify problems to the board. A second case and subsequent inquiries motivated the government to introduce mandatory reporting in 2009, with notifiable conduct categories mirroring those in New South Wales. Here again, the AMA argued that the legislation was unnecessary due to existing ethical obligations. But once the AMA accepted that it would occur, that is, the introduction of this new legislation with mandatory reporting, it argued, as in New South Wales, for high thresholds for reporting, such as not just a departure from accepted practice, but flagrant departures from accepted practice, and also for more attention to be paid to systemic factors. Commentators within the profession also pointed to doctors being unfairly made primary targets for systemic failures. So there were three jurisdictions, and now we move to the national jurisdiction with national registration and its mandatory reporting provisions. The requirements and categories under the national registration scheme clearly reflect the state-based developments of the 2000s, in particular in New South Wales and Queensland that I've just described. Not surprisingly, pressure continued to be exerted to attenuate the requirements in the context of the balance between public expectations and the need for public protection on the one hand, and professional autonomy on the other. The most recent changes that we've seen have been in relation to mandatory reporting of impaired health practitioners, and again, this has been mostly in relation to the medical profession. So I'll move now to talk a little bit about mandatory reporting of impaired practitioners. While it's true that the Australian Medical Association has worked diligently and cooperatively with the Medical Board of Australia in relation to doctors' health programs, it has also led the argument to exempt treating doctors from having to notify their practitioner patients to the boards. This is based on the claim that they will be reluctant, that is, the doctors or other health professionals who suffer from some impairment, that they will be reluctant to seek treatment if they perceive that there's a risk from notification of a threat to their careers, for example. Now, the national law that was enacted in 2009 and has been in force since 2010 did not make an exemption, as was sought by the AMA. However, in response to strong lobbying, it did make the notification trigger in cases of impairment a risk of substantial harm. Note the word substantial.
Mm-hmm.
The notification trigger in relation to impairment, but only for treating practitioners, has much more recently, in fact a matter of months, been changed from this risk of substantial harm to a substantial risk of harm. The substantial risk of harm for treating practitioners applies to impairment per se, but it also applies to intoxication and departures from professional standards. It is considered that the higher thresholds recently introduced should prevent cases such as a mental health crisis being seen to constitute a notifiable impairment. I'll finish my comments about mandatory reporting and the recent changes by noting that Western Australia has long been the outlier in terms of mandatory reporting, because Western Australia decided to exempt treating practitioners from mandatory reporting of all forms of notifiable conduct in cases of health professional patients. And pressure has continued over the past 10 years to adopt the Western Australian model in all states and territories. And this pressure will continue despite the recent raising of reporting thresholds.
It's really interesting about not only the change to the reporting threshold and, you know, the highly nuanced use of words like risk of substantial harm versus substantial risk of harm. So I assume that it would be any level of harm, but also what Western Australia is doing. So obviously they have felt that it is an impediment, you know, this idea of notifiable reports would be an impediment to someone seeking treatment from their colleague. Do you think that's what that...
That's been the basis of Western Australia's... the route that Western Australia has taken, and it's been the basis for the arguments that the AMA and other groups have put to the government in relation to exempting treating practitioners from mandatory reporting of their health professional patients. One of the issues that arises there, and one of the problems, is that the evidence for patients who are also health professionals not coming forward and seeking treatment is rather thin on the ground.
Mm.
And so I'll make a point in a minute about the requirement for evidence. It's one thing to make a claim that health professionals will not come forward for treatment if they perceive a risk, but we simply don't know very much about, you know, what actually happens on the ground from research.
No, that's very interesting. So, Mal, what kind of take-home messages would you like to leave with the listener today?
Well, I think a number of points arise from this sort of history that I've tried to cover in relation to mandatory reporting. I think that mandatory reporting illustrates the inevitable tension between traditionally autonomous professions and the regulatory processes that implement democratically demanded protections. Secondly, I think that professional associations like the AMA, and it is the AMA that's been in the vanguard of debates and arguments concerning mandatory reporting, associations like the AMA legitimately represent the welfare of their members, and organisations like the AMA understandably argue for proscribing mandatory reporting in cases where it is believed this would dissuade impaired practitioners from seeking treatment. So we can understand what the AMA is on about there, but of course, as I said earlier, there is the evidence for all these things is a little thin on the ground. So belief-based assertions about the value of existing ethical imperatives or the reluctance by practitioners to seek treatment shouldn't be regarded as authoritative. Rather, we need evidence about these things, and this should inform the understanding of the benefits and harms of mandatory reporting. And in this regard, I think it's important and would be helpful for people wishing to read further to look at the work of Marie Bismarck and David Studdert and their colleagues over the past decade, because they constitute the leading Australian source of empirical data which concerns mandatory reporting. They've done some incredible research, not just related to the medical profession, but other of the health professions, in trying to tease out what the facts are about mandatory reporting, its effects, and its benefits. Another point that I'd make is that even the previous thresholds for notifying impaired practitioners excluded the vast majority of cases from requiring notification. And the statutory regime that we've had now for 10 years, and we continue to have, the regime of mandatory reporting, demands no more than what medical bodies claim about the effectiveness of their own, if you like, internal ethical obligations. So it's a bit difficult to understand the strength of resistance other than as resentment of encroachments on the profession's social autonomy and authority. I think mandatory reporting of individuals is very important, clearly, but it shouldn't overshadow the need for other systems and robust systems to also ensure the safety of patients. And there are a number of other systems which I won't go into, but which do just that. I think finally I'd say that self-regulation, and the listener might be thinking that I've been rather critical of self-regulation, particularly in the medical profession, but I think that self-regulation itself will never be completely extinguished. That is, we will never get to a point where it's only external regulation of whether it's medical or nursing practitioners or other health practitioners of their behaviour. Successful external processes like mandatory reporting depend on individual and collective professional integrity, contributing to a robust internal professional morality. So as we move forward, I think that self-regulation and some measure of external regulation, which mandatory reporting is an example of, have to go hand in hand.
Mm. And I think that's a common feature of all professions. So it's not an issue that's confined to the health professionals. So we tend to see that across the board. Hey, now, Mel, I'm wondering if you could give me some examples of the types of risks and reporting thresholds for different groups. Say, for example, when a treating practitioner must report another practitioner who might be practicing with alcohol and drugs or does something that places the public at risk. Would that be the kind of thing that would be reportable?
Yeah, I think treating practitioners, and when we talk about treating practitioners, we're talking about, for example, a doctor who might be treating another doctor for a medical condition, or might be treating a nurse or another health practitioner. They must, under the legislation, report their practitioner patient. If they are practicing with an impairment and placing the public at substantial risk of harm, that's in terms of impairment. Mm. The wording, I think you alluded to the wording a little earlier in relation to the sort of the subtleties of the wording, and I think there are some difficulties with the wording that's probably a bit too complicated to go into at the moment.
On a podcast, yeah, definitely. I think, though, and you often see that the loading of words, especially if there's anyone with any law degree writing as well, where you see this emphasis on things like a significant departure or, you know, significant risk of harm, but then often it's really not clear what significant is, and it really depends on the circumstances. So in terms of practical guidance, it's quite hard for health professionals to sort of come to grips with a lot of these concepts, do you think?
I think it is very difficult because these terms are sort of value-laden, they're loaded sorts of terms. So as you imply there, you know, what does the word significant mean? I think that the medical board does make an attempt through the sort of subsidiary documentation for all these rules to give guidance as to what significant means. For example, what's a significant departure from professional standards? The way they do that is to give examples, because it's one thing for you to say something that is significant, and I will disagree. What's significant about that? So these are very difficult verbal, potentially disputes, which we can argue about. And probably the best thing that can be done is what the board does, and that is to give some examples, you know, of what is a significant departure from professional standards.
And it's always those ones that fall into the grey areas that are the most difficult. Well, Mal, thank you for spending time with us, and we really appreciate you sharing your knowledge with us today about professional conduct and the culture of medicine.
That's a pleasure, Nicola. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you.
Well, I hope we'll have many more opportunities in podcasts just like this. Well, thank you all for listening to the Integrity in Health series. So today it has been Professor Mal Parker and me, Nicola Stepanov, the Queensland Integrity Commissioner. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Thank you.